Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Doctor Family podcast. Unfortunately, we've been rather busy over the last few weeks since the end of lockdown, which has led to an increased pressure in general practice, and we find ourselves back up to the normal levels we'd be seeing within winter. I've had to, of course, concentrate on my day job. Today, however, we're going to be covering a very important condition that requires early recognition for a good outcome. We're going to start by hearing from someone who's experienced this condition firsthand. Let's hear Laura's story.
My story starts on the 3rd of February last year. It started off with a hug. It didn't cause any infection. However, that is what changed my reasoning. So I was going into a nursing home, seeing like all my patients do their feet, and saw one particular lady. She saw me and she was like, "Oh my goodness, Laura, it's so lovely to see you. Can I have a hug?" I've been treating her feet for about 2 years, and you kind of would have to be really heartless not to. So I gave her a hug and we had a bit of a chat, and then I was like, right, I've got to really go and do some work now. And I thought nothing of it until about 7 o'clock that night, because I was still writing my note. I saw her being wheeled out on a stretcher and she was being taken to hospital, and it turned out that she had uncontrollable sickness and diarrhea. And my one response was, oh, beep, I gave her a hug earlier. So 2 days later, when I woke up with sickness and diarrhea and toothache in my right side, I was like, great, I've caught the bug off my patient, but I've also got toothache. It was actually the start of the infection grasping hold. I actually had no neck when I woke up 2 days later. So on the Thursday, so the 7th of February, I woke up with no neck, could hardly breathe. I had a high temperature. I was shaking so much with rigor that it looked like I was having a fit. I was still being the typical healthcare professional and not wanting to put any pressure on the NHS, and saying, I'm not going to go to A&E, I'll go to the doctors. I went to the doctors and he was like, I'm not a mouth specialist. He'd taken my temperature. It wasn't excessively high. It was high, but it wasn't at the point where it was 38.2, which would be a significant temperature, as they would say. But I was in a lot of pain. My O2 sats weren't getting to the point where they were really low at that particular point. I was fast breathing, really confused, hallucinating. At 8:30 in the morning when I phoned the doctors, I actually hallucinated that the doctors were shut that day and were having training. I told my mum, the doctors are shut due to training, and so she got me in 20 minutes later. And I knew that I was out of it by that point. The doctor was like, I'm not a mouth specialist, you need to go to the dentist. So I was like, right, okay, we got an emergency appointment with the dentist. We were there within an hour. I'd already had one tablet of amoxicillin, was on the dentist chair for 2 minutes, and she was like, I don't want to scare you, but you need IV antibiotics now. And then that's when I was thinking, oh, I know what this means. It's not good. There were 44 people in A&E, and I went in within 2 minutes to see triage. They must have known I was really ill at the reception, because while I was with triage, the MaxFax team came in to triage. So within about 5 minutes, I'd actually had an x-ray as well on my jaw. And within about 10 seconds, they were like, Laura, and they got me over, they put an IV, because that's really what they need to do. They then actually wheeled me to a bed in majors, because it wasn't good. By that point, my oxygen levels had gone down to 89. So I wasn't getting enough oxygen in my blood. Hence, I was really confused. I was then put on oxygen and antibiotics, fluids, and all that, and everything was being monitored. 100% oxygen was there. I was actually on antibiotics, fluids, and steroids, and all of that for about 5.5 hours before I had to have major surgery, because they had to put drains in my neck. And because my neck was so swollen, I'd been looking like a hamster before. So I was, after the surgery, I was looking like Frankenstein's monster crossed with a hamster. It was not a good look.
I hope you found Laura's story as interesting as I did. Laura was suffering, in fact, from a rare condition called Ludwig's angina, but this then developed into an important and considerably less rare condition that you will have heard about called sepsis. Briefly, to touch on the rare condition she had, Ludwig's angina, this is a condition caused by an infection to the soft tissues under the floor of the mouth, which can spread down the neck tissues, leading to a feeling of strangulation caused by the swelling to these areas. It is very rare. I remember reading about it and hearing about it as a medical student, but I'm happy to say I'd never seen a case up to this point. The condition was first described by a German physician from the 1800s called Carl Friedrich von Ludwig in 1836. He was a German physician, and I feel there's a bit of a pattern forming here, having recently talked about another German physician from a similar area called Virchow. If you want to hear more about him, his amazing stories regarding the sausage duel of 1865, as well as the important steps he's made into blood clotting, then please do listen to our episode Clotcasts, which you'll find on our website. In the story that Laura tells, she describes having no neck at one point, and this was absolutely due to the swelling caused by this infection of the soft tissues. This would have somewhat further complicated her condition, and it was why the maxillofacial, the MaxFax surgeons were involved in trying to get the drains in surgically to drain away the infection. This makes the airway much more difficult to manage for the anaesthetist who would have been looking after her at the same time. In today's podcast, however, we really want to talk about sepsis, how you can recognise it to help save a life, what needs to be done when sepsis is recognised, and then we touch on the important and sometimes long recovery that is experienced by people who happily do survive sepsis. This is often known as post-sepsis syndrome. So, what is sepsis? Sepsis is defined as a life-threatening condition which is triggered by an infection. However, the life-threatening aspect of it is generally caused by the body's immune system and its reaction to that infection. The infections that cause sepsis are most commonly bacterial ones, such as the meningococcal sepsis that you would all have seen pictures of, the ones that we're very aware of, particularly in children and young people, and the ones that we're using the glass test on the rashes, showing a rash that doesn't disappear under the pressure of a glass is something that really needs to be attended to rapidly. Sepsis can, however, be triggered by other infections, such as those caused by viruses, fungi, or indeed, in some rare cases, by parasites. When the body's immune system reacts rather over-exuberantly to these infectious triggers, it can lead to a series of events which can ultimately lead to fluid leaking out of the tissues, the dropping of blood pressure, all of which can lead to the failure of multiple organs, along with the dysregulation of the clotting systems, leading to blood clots forming inappropriately, as well as bleeding once all of those clotting factors have been used up in these clots. These odd forms of bleeding under the skin are actually what lead to the non-blanching rashes that don't disappear under the pressure of a glass. Organ failure, fluid going where it shouldn't do, can lead to damage to the lungs, leading to breathing difficulties, can lead to cardiac failure if there is not sufficient fluid within the circulatory system to pump the blood around the body, as well as causing damage to kidneys, the brain, and ultimately, if we're not treating it appropriately or unlucky, it can sadly kill you. Early recognition of the signs of sepsis are absolutely key, because it's clear that the earlier that medical help can be sought, the better the outcome for the patient. It is so important, in fact, that charities such as the Sepsis Trust take great efforts to ensure that as many people as possible know about the symptoms to look out for. In general practice, we make sure that everyone, especially our frontline, namely our reception teams, are alert to look out for and listen out for the signs of sepsis, so that patients showing these signs can get early help. Here's a story illustrating the importance of this.
I was speaking to World Sepsis Day Ambassador Jess Tuckfield, and she said that she was trying to get an appointment for 2 days. And then on the last day, she was like, you know what? I've got to see a doctor. So she actually drove to the doctor's and actually said, I'm not leaving until I actually get a doctor. And it was actually the receptionist that were like, no, you're getting an ambulance. And it was the reception at the doctor's.
So we heard both in Laura's story, where unfortunately the GP she first saw hadn't recognised the sepsis and that it was her dentist that caught it and sent her in, and in this latest episode here, where indeed our frontline teams, who are generally excellent at doing this sort of thing and flagging it to the doctors, recognised sepsis and sent the patient into the accident and emergency via ambulance. So what do you want to be looking out for in people to check whether they may have sepsis? So let's start with adults. Adults may initially feel like they have flu or gastroenteritis or indeed a chest infection. Initially, early symptoms may include having a fever, chills and shivering, which makes it very difficult to differentiate between having a flu or indeed having sepsis. Other things they start to look out for would be a fast heart rate or rapid breathing. More advanced signs, which I think you should definitely be seeking immediate help for, may include feeling dizzy or faint, signs of confusion, as we heard in this story with Laura, and disorientation. As we heard in Laura's story, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or indeed cold, clammy, pale, or mottled skin are signs which should prompt us to be seeking medical help. In children, fevers are very common as they fight off childhood illness, particularly as they go back to school or childcare. However, any child who's breathing very rapidly, has a fit or convulsion, looks blue, mottled or pale, or has a rash that doesn't fade when it's pressed, may have sepsis and you should certainly be getting them checked out rapidly. Other things that we would be looking out for, particularly in babies or children under 5, would be vomiting repeatedly, not having a wet nappy or peeing for 12 hours. They should definitely be discussed with a medical professional. So, when you've recognised sepsis, what happens next? Well, just like the reception team or the dentist, get that patient to hospital. The earlier they can get treatment started, the better their chances of a good outcome. When they do finally get to a hospital in A&E, there's a great deal of emphasis now placed on something called the Sepsis 6. This is a bundle of care which is delivered initially and ideally within the first hour of the diagnosis of sepsis being made. It includes giving the patient oxygen to make sure that the oxygen levels are brought to a target of 94% or above. Blood cultures are taken in order to try and find the source of the infection and to make sure that any subsequent treatments which are given are targeted appropriately for that organism. The patient is also given intravenous antibiotics, and regular measurements of a chemical in the blood called lactate are looked to see whether the body is dealing with the infection well, whether it's getting appropriate amounts of oxygen and fuel, or whether it's building up an acidosis, a buildup of acid within the blood, which is suggestive that things are not going quite so well. Intravenous fluids are also started in order to keep the blood pressure up and look after the organs to ensure that they get the sufficient fluids and blood supply. A lot of monitoring goes on, particularly looking at the urine output to check on the kidney function, which is one of the early organs to be affected by sepsis. And interestingly, evidence has shown that by using this care bundle of the Sepsis 6, there was an incredible 50% reduction in the mortality of patients who receive it. So, after that initial Sepsis 6, within the hours or so of the infection being recognised, people may often require intensive care. Intensive care is a very specialised unit where there is close monitoring of patients with a high staff-to-patient ratio. We'll have been hearing an awful lot about this during the COVID crisis. Within an intensive care setting, they'll be monitoring all of the major functions of the body and are able to step in with intensive therapies to support those organs, such as the lungs, heart, and kidneys, while the body takes time to recover. Laura, who's been thinking an awful lot about sepsis following her experience, has been a passionate advocate for the best care that can be given for all patients with sepsis. She's indeed working with various organisations around the world to roll out the Sepsis 6 care package to make sure that all patients going into a hospital get this treatment. Although we still don't know fully why some people would go on to develop sepsis while others wouldn't from a particular infection, there are some groups of patients who are more prone to sepsis than others. As always, it seems to be the very young or the very old patients. Patients with diabetes, those who are on long-term steroids or drugs that would potentially affect their immune system, such as those where cancer is being treated, or other patients who may be severely malnourished or have other conditions such as severe liver disease. People who've also just undergone major operations, or who are pregnant, or have just given birth, are also at an increased risk. Happily, we are getting somewhat better at managing and recognising this condition, and as we've seen with COVID, once we know a little bit better how to manage it, the chances of survival are increasing. Interestingly, dexamethasone, one of the medications talked about in the treatment of COVID-19, is something that's been used in intensive care for treating patients with sepsis for a long time. So, we've managed to recognise sepsis, we've talked about how it's treated and managed in the acute phase while people are still critically ill, but happily, once people have come through the illness, that's not necessarily the end of the story.
I bet it's the aftermath that actually is the bit that is the killer. I was actually speaking to a few people and they were saying that there's actually a massive amount of grief about losing one's sense of self, because you can never be the same person. Like with me, I had all but three symptoms of post-sepsis syndrome. So I was having my hair falling out. I was having really dry, flaky nails. I was having massive bouts of insomnia, but I was also getting nightmares, which meant that I didn't want to go to sleep either. And these were like really vivid flashbacks with the nightmares. But then you've also got extreme tiredness. And like when it comes to like the fatigue, so many people kind of hear fatigue and just be like, yeah, well, whatever. They're just tired. But I would be in work. I would be writing my note. And then I'd actually be phoned 2.5 hours later because it was 10:30 at night. Like, where are you? Oh, I fell asleep. Some days when I'd actually got home, I actually would have to sit in the car for about an hour because everything was like lead. So my body felt like it was about 10 times heavier than it was. And like your taste changes. That's the really weird one that I didn't realize. PTSD. And at the moment, I'm actually going through rather a lot of PTSD where I'm actually having about 10 to 20 panic attacks each day.
As we heard, unfortunately, Laura's been struggling with post-sepsis syndrome since her recovery from the initial sepsis bout. These symptoms are both physical and psychological. Fatigue and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, being the two major things that she's struggling with. Other people may sadly have other longer-standing physical consequences. Some may lose limbs or suffer irreparable damage to their organs. It's a well-known fact that people with severe infections such as pneumonia can take an awful long time to get better. Indeed, I always tell my patients who have unfortunately developed pneumonia, no matter how young or fit they are, they could take a good 6 months to get back to where they were before the pneumonia started. Laura describes her fatigue, along with the psychological outcomes, which are common for anyone who's been through a severe illness like this, or indeed been on intensive care for any length of time. If, sadly, you've been affected by any of the conditions mentioned in the podcast today, or are indeed keen to learn more, please do check out the Sepsis Trust, whose website I will link in the show notes and on our website, as well as Laura's podcast. She interviews other fellow sepsis survivors. They talk together and describe their experiences. They talk about how they're coping with their post-sepsis syndrome. And then they campaign to improve the lot of other people developing sepsis throughout the world. Her show will indeed be linked in our show notes and on our website. We are very grateful for everyone's kind attention to our podcast, our growing support for the show. We've recently been interviewed on radio and the local newspapers, and it's been heartwarming to get the responses from our listeners. However, with the increased workload that we're seeing in general practice since the end of the lockdown, I suspect we're going to be struggling to regularly put out the same sort of content every 2 weeks. We are therefore considering a couple of options of how we can continue the podcast, and we would be really grateful for any thoughts you may have on what you'd prefer. One of the thoughts would be for Nina and I to perhaps cover and round up what's been in the newspapers over the last couple of weeks regarding healthcare, perhaps with some other special episodes interweaved with interviews such as the ones we've covered up till now. An alternative would be for us to do less frequent episodes of a similar kind to the ones we've done up to this point. Please do let us know, either through Facebook, email, or through our website, what you think you'd prefer. We hope you've enjoyed today's show and learnt a little bit about sepsis, this important condition. Please do let us know how we're doing. Rate or review our podcast in your podcast player or indeed on Podchaser. We hope you've enjoyed the show. As always, we're being played out by the fabulous music of Drew Worthley. Until next time, goodbye.
Che Guevara is on my